Hello and welcome to 3-Point Perspective, the podcast about illustration, how to do it, how to make a living at it, and how to make an impact in the world with your art. I'm Jake Parker.
And I'm Lee White.
And I'm Will Terry. All three of us are professional illustrators, and we've been working for about the last 25 years. We've worked with just about every major publisher in the business, and all of us together, I think we have about 50 children's books, and we've all taught illustration at universities.
Each week, we are going to tackle a different subject relating to illustration from our three perspectives. Sometimes we're going to agree, sometimes we're going to scrap, but you guys are going to learn something every time.
Great.
You know, someone said the other day that we don't disagree enough.
We haven't gotten far enough into the episodes. I think the fan art one.
Yeah. They said that before the fan art, before they heard the fan art one.
Right.
Because that one, we were at each other's throats practically, right?
Yeah.
No.
But everybody loves the fan art one now that it's released, so.
As of this recording, we haven't released that one yet, so quit your shenanigans.
I was talking into the future.
It
was fun.
This is episode 9, and we've recorded, we've only released 3 episodes so far. So if you're listening to the way you can hear this is because you are listening. Because you are listening to this episode, I just want you to know that's where we're at with the schedule on these. We've done 10 of these, or I guess at the end of this, we'll have done 10. Wow. Congrats, you guys. I just want to say, too, thank you to everybody who's reviewed the podcast. And we've read all of those reviews, and we love them. We love the feedback we've been getting, and really like this community that's building around the podcast. So thank you for that, everybody who's reviewed them. All right, so let's get right into today's topic. It's on Lee's shoulders today. He's going to tackle this one today, and Will and I will give our
disagreements,
give our thoughts, our disagreements. But Lee, you want to take it away?
Okay, so this was prompted from a question. A listener, Jason Roche or Roche or Roche. I don't want to mess it up, so I'm going to give every pronunciation that I can. I still probably mangled it.
I thought it was Roachi.
Rocha.
The question is, how much will you make in illustration? Talk about different areas. And once I saw that, I definitely perked up because it's right up my alley. I have the business class that I did for SVS, which I really loved making. But more importantly, I wanted to take this because it was one of my greatest frustrations that when you're in school or you're trying to, you know, you're a student of illustration, you're trying to learn. And you talk about everything, brushes and paint and highlights and rendering and everything. And you never talk about what it's like to actually make a living as an illustrator. I mean, we never talked actual dollars in school. Did you guys ever have instructors that really broke it down?
No.
It was so lacking.
It sucks.
No. That's amazing to me that in Art Center, that wasn't like a part of the curriculum.
No, and it really wasn't. And if anything, it's frowned upon, and it's still frowned upon. And I've come to, I'll just throw out my kind of hypothesis on it. It comes with two things. Either you're not making enough and you feel like that's kind of a reflection on you, that you don't want to be embarrassed that you didn't make enough, or you make a lot and you're embarrassed about that and you don't want to, put that out there too to make other people feel bad or make it seem like you're bragging. So then no one talks about it.
Right.
And it's just really, really frustrating because you don't know as a new illustrator what it means to make a living as an illustrator. You know about the art and you know about all the stuff and even about the different fields, but really understanding what your life, we're going to talk about money in this episode and making a living, but what we're really talking about is making a life of illustration. It's one of the things over the past like 2 years that I've really started to hone in on when given this kind of a lecture. And that is, once you choose to be an illustrator as a pro, you're going to each avenue where whichever way you go is going to come with a life with it. If you pick animation, there's going to be a lifestyle with that. If you pick book publishing, there's a lifestyle. And I really like pushing it because it's the one missing ingredient, I think, before we get into the actual numbers, that, you know, if you're a if you're a social person and you're and you pick wrong, you could be in a studio by yourself all day. And that's a problem, just as a life problem. It's not a financial problem, but it's just a life problem. If you're really social, maybe being an entertainment designer where you're in a studio might be better for you. Or if you're uncomfortable with not knowing when you're going to get paid, that's a huge part of being an illustrator. I mean, there's not a single illustrator listening who's made money who hasn't had some kind of client payment problem. So are you okay with that? Yeah. Or do you need that weekly paycheck? And that may be a different kind of thing too. And so just kind of what I want to stress getting going is like everything you're studying in school, whether you're editorial illustrator or book publishing or entertainment arts or storyboarding or whatever, each one of those comes with a speed attached to it, like how fast you have to work, how much money you're going to make, the nature of how you're going to be paid.
Yeah, all that. Well, to back up just for a second, we were talking about schools. And one of the reasons I think that we don't talk about it in school is because the school is kind of faced with keeping enrollment up. And that's when they tell you, come to our school, you can get a good career. And then when you're exiting, they're like, well, hold on now. We never told you that you were going to get a job, right? Because they don't want the responsibility, and you can understand, you know, it's an unknown kind of an entity out there. But I think... Well,
go ahead, and then I got a disagreement.
Okay, yeah. Well, really important part of being a teacher is taking the student from the beginning all the way through the end. And for me, I always felt it was a responsibility to talk the business side, because I knew all my students were really into that. So I made it a point to talk about how much they could make in each different field every single semester. I would just take one day and we would lay it out and they would throw out all their questions. And usually I would get comments like, no one's ever talked to us about this before. And I've approached other teachers and they really kind of, either they've been there so long that they're not really working as illustrators anymore, so they don't feel like they're educated enough to give that lecture, or they're not making enough money, so they don't want to brag about how much they're not making, or they are, but they, like you said, Lee, they don't want to brag, you know? Mm-hmm. So money's always this kind of weird thing to talk about, but man, it's important.
It's weird how closely people hold it to the vest too. There was a job that I got I guess about a year ago now, to do these posters for a hospital. And I found out that another illustrator that I know of had done a job for the same group for hospital posters. I mean, it's not a job that comes up often. So I'm just kind of grabbing, you know, shooting in the dark about how much to charge for these things. And so I thought, oh, I'll send an email to him and just say, like, just put me in the ballpark. You don't have to tell me exactly how much you specifically made, but just kind of get me oriented to where we are here. And he was uncomfortable even given just basic information like that. Mm-hmm. So I had to throw it out there, and you know, maybe I left money on the table. Maybe I overcharged. I still have no idea, but I was just shocked at how non forthcoming the information is.
That is frustrating. What I was going to say though is, you know, we're focused specifically on illustration, but if you have artistic ability, the gamut of jobs available are, you know, everywhere from doing, you know, freelance out of your home to working for a full, you know, full time for an animation studio or a video game studio. And I know that the BYU where I taught, the animation department was really big on placing their students in jobs and flying out people from DreamWorks, people from Pixar, and forming a good relationship and setting up with internships and making sure that, you know, right out of school, that these kids had a job lined up at these studios. The problem, I think, with illustration is there's no central source providing all illustration jobs. It's everywhere, and you can fly an editor out and talk to the students, and they could be from one publishing house, but that doesn't mean you're going to have full-time work from that publishing house for the next 5 years, like you would maybe at an animation studio. So there is like some inherent problems with the career of illustrating that I think it's kind of hard to set yourself up for you know, consistent work right out of school. But I think there's things that you can do, and there's ways that you can sort of gear yourself towards lining up jobs even before you graduate, and lining up work and having the right relationships and knowing the right people so that you are starting to get consistent work as you graduate.
Yeah. And understanding the rhythm and how your career evolves is going to be key too. So you understand where you are and what the focus should be on at different mm-hmm. stages and, mm-hmm. and what the expectations are. I mean, I remember when I left school, I had no idea how much illustrators made at any stage. Did you guys, when you left, or like Will, when you came out of school and you start hitting the streets?
I did, because I had a few teachers that were adjuncts, and the adjuncts are usually the gold that kind of happens at a university mm-hmm. art program. And I had Rob Colvin and a guy named Greg Halley. I don't know if he's still working as an illustrator, but Rob Colvin is now is doing more fine art. But at the time, you know, Rob was, I think, the second highest earner in the stock illustration SIS. And he was making $300,000 plus a year just selling his second rights. So that didn't include his freelance. And he was doing a lot of annual reports and things like that. And he was such a neat guy, and he let us come over to his house if we wanted to come and ask him questions and stuff. And so I went up to his house twice, and I just came with a list of questions. I'm like, okay, you know, and just nailed him with it. And that was having access to someone like that made the what I was going to attempt to try to do in becoming a freelance illustrator a real thing that I could then take to my parents and go, I'm not crazy. I mean, I am crazy, but it's not as crazy as this sounds, because I've got this guy, and let me answer some of your questions, because this is what he's telling me. And my parents were like rolling their eyes, like, well, whatever, I guess, you know, at least he's not out killing people.
yeah. So, I mean, I think all it takes is you know, a couple people kind of just talking about it, and you can get oriented pretty quick. So let's go ahead and dive in. Like Jake said, it's pretty tough to nail this down. So maybe that's a reason people don't talk about it, but it's going to be tough for us to nail down too. So don't think, by the way, if you don't line up with one of these things, that's, you know, you're either a failure or that you're even better than what we're talking about. It's just kind of, we're just kind of throwing out ballpark things, and you can kind of line up with where you are, but know that this is not like a criteria that you have to be hitting or something. So we're just going to try to, like I said, ballpark the numbers and you can kind of go from there depending on what your individual situation is. So I kind of set up six little categories that go together. Actually, two categories, and there's three little subs of each. So there's three different income brackets in terms of being an illustrator that I've broken it down into. And that is the early pro. That's basically the years 1 to 3 or 1 to 4. The mid-level pro, where you're getting some traction, and then pro, like where you're seasoned vet. And the income distribution there is pretty drastic. So it's just important to talk about that, because if we just said, oh, this is how much illustrators make, well, which one of those are you talking about? If you're talking about Chris Van Helsberg.
That's funny that you mentioned him, because I have him listed in my notes.
Yeah. I mean, he's just like kind of he's won the Caldecott multiple times. If we use him as a guide, that would be totally misleading. And the same thing is if we pick somebody who just graduated from college last year, it's going to be different. So we'll try to address each one of those phases if we can.
Let me give you an interesting factoid about Chris. Just for, you know, how many books do you think he's done?
32.
Okay. I have no idea. But he did the Polar Express, right? He wrote and illustrated it. And in 2015, he sold 158,000 copies. Now, that book was published, I believe, 20 years prior. So it has been selling for the past 25 years. So he sold 158,000 copies in 2015. That equates to roughly, with his 10%, $230,000 just from that book.
And he's done it multiple times. The same thing with David Wiesner, too, who's won multiple Caldecotts. You got to think these things are just in constant print.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So they are definitely not the norm, But they are definitely, you know, when you look, when you think about what's my, you know, you, I think it's helpful to have a dream, you know, kind of job and like, what's the highest I can go, you know, thinking of those guys. And it's not a bad life if you're pulling down, you know, over 200,000 based on royalties.
Right.
Okay. So we got early pro, mid pro, and season pro. And then what goes with that is exceptional skill, average skill, and below average skill. And so you have to know that you're going to have one of those. I don't like just saying, oh, what's a student make? There was a couple of my friends at Art Center who shot right out of the gate and they're making easily six figures right out of the gate. They had an absolutely exceptional skill set that's not normal. And luck came with it too, and connections too. But just talking skill, we knew in school those guys were going to be awesome, and they were. You know, people like Kang Lee, Chris Appelhans, those guys already were making a lot of money in school. They were in high demand in school.
Wow.
So you can't use them as the average. So
wasn't Dan Santat one of your classmates?
He graduated a term or two in front of me, and he had the kind of unique experience that every SCBWI, for those of you guys who don't know that, Society of Children's Book Writers and Illustrators, SCBWI has conferences every year. And he had gone to the summer conference right at the end when, I don't know if school was still in session or not, but right as he was ending school. And then he gets plucked up, gets a publishing deal for writing his own book right at the conference. That's what everyone dreams of. It does not have, that's the exception to the rule, but he had that happen. And so, you know, you got to think, which one of these little areas am I in? I'm going to be kind of talking about average skill, not the people with exceptional skill, because they shoot right to the top and they're an outlier. And so is the people with below average skill. They just don't end up getting a job at all.
Yeah. We're not comparing tradesmen who are doing, you know, the same job. You know, like I used to do drywall, and when you finish drywall, it's either smooth or it's not done. You know what I mean? If you make a weld, it's either going to hold and it's going to be a good weld, or it's going to fail. And what we're talking about in doing artwork is everybody's style is different. Everybody's style takes a different amount of time.
Yeah, exactly. So let's dive right into it. There's a couple of different areas in illustration. We'll talk about our own histories, obviously, over the course of this, but I thought we'd start with the book publishing industry, because that's where most of us live. But we'll go through a couple of different ones, including entertainment, concept art, art fairs and cons and that kind of stuff. And just kind of generally what you can expect from an early pro, mid pro, and seasoned pro kind of expectations. Right now, I would think that a early pro, that means you're 1 to 3 years out of school, 1 to 4 years out of school, you get a publishing deal from a real publisher. This is not with an author, self-publishing kind of gig. You're going to be looking at about $8,000 to $10,000 for that, for that advance. And it is an advance if you're in the trade book publishing industry, not educational. Educational, they typically just pay for the work outright, and there's no royalties attached to it. So what I'm talking about is trade book, where you do get a royalty. But so it's about $8,000 to $10,000. That's for an early pro. The mid pro, that means you're 5 to 7 years in, you're going to be around $20,000 to maybe $24,000 for a book. And then once you're into your seasoned, I'd say 7 or 8 years and up, you could be looking at around $28,000 or higher. You guys agree with that, or what do you think?
That's about right from my experience.
Yeah.
Okay. So with book publishing, that's generally the rates. Now, some things change with different publishers and different areas of publishing. Like I said, educational rates will probably be half that. Mm-hmm. And you rarely go higher than the lowest rung of that little grouping that I just had, around $10,000. For an educational publisher, you'd be lucky to get $10,000, and it will never go higher than $10,000.
Now, can I add something in there? I guess I already am. So yes, I can. I'm going to add something. there are the really small publishers out there, and some of them will offer a few thousand dollars. And the question I get all the time is, you know, from a student or from a beginning illustrator is, I've got this offer, it seems really low, should I take it? You know, and I never answer that in a yes or no. I kind of talk a lot about, you know, your bottom line and all the factors that go into it. I don't know if you want to go down that road now, but I just wanted to insert the fact that there are small, medium, and large size publishers. And I think the numbers that you're quoting, Lee, are more for the larger publishers.
They are. But it's a great time to bring that up. I mean, I've got a couple of little notes in here, and I don't know where to put them, so we might as well just go ahead and throw them out there. I have a list of questions to ask yourself. Should you take work? Like Will said, you get an offer. Hey, wait a second. It's not in the 10K range that I was supposed to get. It's only 4K. Should I do it or not? Like Will said, there's different criteria. So my three criteria are, first, does it pay well? In this case, your $4,000 offer well below the actual rate. Is it creative or is it pushing you in a direction that you want to go? In other words, are you going to get a fantastic portfolio piece out of it? If you answer yes to that, then that would be definitely one to consider. And the last one is it going to be a piece that has some kind of extraordinary exposure?
Like maybe it's a celebrity author and they won't let you put your name on it even.
Right.
I've heard of those.
That's not exposure if your name's not on it.
Well, you're right. But is it exposure in the fact that you can take that book and show it as a portfolio piece to other editors, you know?
Yeah, but...
Let's just say that your name is attached to it to not go down such a small road. But how I use those three things together is if I get a job and I can check off all three of those boxes, it pays well, it's super creative, and it's going to be heavy exposure. That's like a best case scenario. What I look for in jobs that I definitely or lean towards taking, I guess, is it checks two out of the three. I try to make it definitely have two out of the three. If it has only one of those, then you evaluate your situation and see, is it far enough into one of those that makes it worthwhile?
Yeah.
And it tends to work pretty well as I've taught classes and you know, when somebody comes up and asks me, like you were saying, Will, they ask, you know, I'm not getting what I should, what should I do? I throw it out to the whole class and we use that criteria as a way to interview the student and see if they should take it or not. We debate it back and forth. And so there's no hard yeses or hard no's.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So that's book publishing. And that's kind of the general ranges. Once you're at the senior level, you know, the 28K and it like Will said, it definitely goes up if you start getting notoriety, you start winning awards. Just for what it's worth, there was my previous agent, there was a artist on the roster who had won just the Caldecott honor. And I think his royalty rate 2 years ago, just for that singular year, was around 80K for just the royalties.
That's great.
So it's just so cool. I mean, that's one of the beautiful things, you know, talking about a life in these areas. As a book publisher, it's kind of like investing in stock. I think of book publishing really is. As a long-term kind of endeavor.
A side note to that is that his honor book that he got for the Caldecott is going to stay in print probably forever. And so that means that there will be royalty checks coming in every 6 months for the rest of his life probably.
Yeah. And so that's the pros. You know, if we're talking pros and cons of each one of these industries, that's the pro you can build a long-term career out of it with passive income, which is kind of cool.
Not only that, also if he's got a backlist of 10 books or 5 books, those are all going to sell, their sales are going to be boosted as well.
And I don't want to put out the idea that when you do a children's book, you get royalties, because actually most children's books do not do what they call earn out. You don't get any royalties.
Me and David Hone argue all day long about that.
Really?
Well, he's had a couple of books that earned out really well. I've had a couple that have earned out, but not nearly to the scale he has. Mm-hmm. And so when I get an offer now, I think I want to get as much as I can up front because I'm assuming this thing's going to die.
Right. Well, most books go out of print.
Yeah.
And that's been my experience. I have about 9 books that I've 9 or well no if I'm thinking children's books, but if you count my graphic novels, I've got, you know, 12 books probably that I've put out. 3 of them I get reliable royalties from, but it's just a couple $1,000s per book. One's maybe $500 a year, which is still, you know, that's nice to see that show up, but it's nothing you can, like, you know, plan around, right? And then you get the other royalty statements that show, okay, you still have to sell 12,000 more copies in order for this to start earning royalties. And you're like, well, that'll never happen.
Right.
But you get your money up front, and it's what's great about it is you we haven't really explained how an advance works.
Just do it really quick, like a 20-second explanation.
20-second one. Yeah, I don't want to derail the whole show. Basically, the publisher gives you an advance on royalties. So, you know, if you're just working on royalties, when the book makes money, then you would make money, right? And so to protect the artists, sometimes what they'll do and to incentivize the artists or the creator, the author, whoever, they'll say, okay, we think this book is going to make $20,000 in royalties for sure. So we're going to pay you $20,000 right now. And then after that book makes the $20,000 and it makes its, you know, its next dollar after $20,000, you'll start getting a royalty check from that extra money after that. So that's the way I understand how it works. And I think that adequately describes it.
That was like a minute.
Too long.
Sorry. Jeez.
Luckily, we can just make this podcast 2 or 3 hours. So it doesn't. Anyway, thinking about royalties is kind of a great way to think about your overall life plan. And if you're thinking long term, like for me, right when I left school, I thought I'm going to do other things in the short term that pay high income short term rates, like concept art, and I'll focus on book publishing for the long term. So you do have to start thinking about these things as a business. It's why I love having this conversation, because it's just a little bit different conversation than art students typically have. That, oh my gosh, it's not sexy at all. Like, you want to be like the artist that's in a cafe sketching and you get plucked up and you get a bunch of money and stuff. But these are businesses and you have to think about them as a business, you know? Okay. So that'll bring us to our second one. And I think Jake and I both have experience here, entertainment and I'm kind of leaning towards concept art. Within mm-hmm. entertainment, like Jake said a few minutes ago, there are so many jobs, and it's a very rich time to get rich, no pun intended, very yes. rich time. You can do a lot of different things, and you can kind of overlap some of this stuff, as Jake has done very successfully. But there's storyboarding and background art and background layout and background painting and in-betweening, you know, once you get into animation, and there's just so much stuff. And so I kind of had to pick, I just picked concept art because it's one that gets thrown out there as kind of a generic idea. Like, I'm going to be a concept artist. What does that mean? So we had to just pick one area, but there's a lot, I just want to stress that there's a lot of different areas. Jake, correct me if I'm wrong on these figures, but for a student leaving school, I taught concept art at the Art Institute of Portland for about 10 years. And what I saw mm-hmm. as an average was about 30, it was kind of low right in the beginning, between 30 and 40K as you know, your 1 to 3. And that's where you got to pay some dues, maybe a little more, maybe. I didn't see it go over that too much.
As a what? As a concept artist full-time at a studio?
Or freelance.
It's early pro, so you know, you're just a junior level person. I know it goes up from there if you have the exceptional mm-hmm. skill. I'm talking about just the average person who gets in the door.
Well, it depends on the studio and the industry. So there's four main industries. There's animation, there's video games, there's television animation, and there's live action, which all need artists, right? And so video games, feature animation, and feature live action are all going to pay higher than television. But television, you might have, if the show goes on for 10 years, you'll have a job for 10 years, right? Usually the production for a video game or a film is a 2-year or 3-year type of commitment. And then it's up to the studio's discretion whether to keep you on or to let you go for future projects. Now, for feature, I've heard of starting wages at the 70K range. And then when you're in it for a few years and you're in that mid-tier, cresting over 6 figures.
Should be noted that feature film is an exceptional skill set it's not the mm-hmm. norm, but you're totally right.
Yeah. And you're competing with, you know, maybe there's 500 artists across all the studios that you'd be competing with in this subset of visual development, concept art type of thing. But then you could top out at a couple hundred thousand a year doing concept art.
Yeah. Feature film is definitely the golden goose in that mm-hmm. one. I'll contrast that with a lot of the students that I saw go into game development, especially mm-hmm. when you're outside of the Los Angeles area here in mm-hmm. Portland. Those game guys get beat up like nobody I've ever seen. They make nothing.
Oh, really?
Yeah, even when they're in it for a couple of years, we've got two studios I know of specifically here, and it's just it never touches that echelon that you're just talking about. So depending mm-hmm. on which area you go to, I mean, it's just another example of knowing where you want to go and knowing right. like, oh, if I can work in feature film or games, oh, I'll just pick one that I like. And that's a crazy way to pick a career because, like Jake said, the pay scale and the environment is so different between them.
I think, though, if you were to get a job at Blizzard or Riot, or if you were to go up to Bungie in Seattle, higher cost of living in those places, and I think it's comparable to feature. And I would say with television, it's going to be lower, at least starting out. I know freelance rates are lower, but it could get comparable the more experience and the more credits that you have to your name.
Without derailing too much, I just want to mention that I've had 5 students in the last 9 years who came back to school from working in, some worked in game studios and others worked in feature animation, and they couldn't make a living in the areas they were living in California and Seattle and stuff. And so it's kind of a dirty secret in the animation industry, in my opinion, that school, one of the reasons why schools don't talk about it is because it's not like they're bragging about you're going to make this $500,000 salary. It's, you know, it's like in the kids that are playing basketball and football, that's all they talk about is, you know, if I can make it to the pros, then, you know, everything's going to be great from there on out money-wise. We just don't have that to brag about.
Right. And what's tough about that is you might, for a feature film, like say Leica is up here. A lot of people get brought up to Leica and they pay a decent wage. And then they go through the production schedule and then the movie gets made and all of a sudden they get canned after like 2 years. You know, that's kind of part of the mm-hmm. normal cycle, which again, it comes down to understanding the life that you're picking and that you might be all of a sudden in a city that wasn't your choosing after 2 years and the production ends and there's not another one or you don't get brought back or whatever.
For anyone that is going to work in animation, just know that even though you get hired on for a job, you should really treat it like you're freelance. Because there will be those droughts almost for every single person in animation that is going to have to deal with making it into the next job.
And there's two things I want to add to this as well. Is it's not just the paycheck, but you're also getting benefits, health benefits. Usually they're pretty good because these are large corporations. You're getting financial benefits that'll match your 401k at a lot of these places. Some of the feature animation studios will have bonus programs. So if the film makes a certain amount of money opening weekend or makes a certain amount of money in its run, the studio will divvy out bonuses. And I've gotten a $20,000 check from bonuses before for working in animation, which is really nice and unexpected and a good thing to look forward to. So there's those benefits as well. You know, it might be a 2-year, 3-year gig. I think the studios are moving more towards trying to keep people longer just because it's financially easier for them to not have to train people. And you know, these people could just hit the ground running on their next thing. So I know people are signing 3-year contracts and re-upping those contracts every 3 years.
The cool things about that is that should be mentioned as a benefit is that you get to work side by side with, you know, 100 other people who are so exactly. good at their job. And exactly. so the learning phase can be very accelerated in that environment.
Yeah. When every time I went to a different animation studio, I leveled up within months of arriving there because it was a new bar, new artists, and I just had to get my work up to the level of what the studio was doing, and it was another huge benefit. The other benefit too is once you have a feature credit or your email address is jake@pixar.com, you know, or something like that, it opens other doors for you. You get freelance offers. You get publishers who are interested in working with someone who's working for Pixar or working for DreamWorks or something like that. So those kind of things help as well. The other thing I want to talk about, though, is there's also people who freelance for television and concept art for, you know, advertising, TV commercials, who freelance for video games. And that's a whole different thing where you're charging a day rate. And those day rates, you know, are sometimes set by the studio. This is all we can afford to pay for this day. Or sometimes you can negotiate that. And so a typical, I think, day rate for feature animation concept art would be $500 a day, in that range for someone who has experience, who's in this season to mid-level pro, and then going lower to, you know, 200 for someone who's maybe just starting out. And then television, I know for freelance, just based on some of the jobs I've done, it's about half of that for a day rate as well.
I disagree.
I disagree with Will's disagree.
No, I'm glad that you pointed out the positives, because there are a lot of positives.
Yeah. I mean, and it goes back to what Lee was saying too, is personality type. Are you social? Do you like stability? You know, as far as for the next few years, I know that I will have a paycheck, you know? And so those things are big. The downside too, though, is a lot of these studios are located in high cost of living areas. So, you know, six figure, you know, $120,000 may not go as far in buying a house or, you know, raising a couple kids as, you know, 80,000 would in Texas.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We actually have a student, I'm not going to mention names. Sorry. I don't know if you guys can hear that popping sound. I keep playing with this little plug that's by my desk and I keep dropping it. So sorry if there's this weird thing.
You're just a fidgety guy.
I'm totally, I need a spinner or something. One of our students lives and works in LA, and she's in the animation industry. And, you know, I see her posts on Facebook, and she kind of has this golden handcuffs type situation where she can't leave LA, but she can't afford to be in LA. Mm-hmm. The job is in LA. That's where her and her husband make a living, mm-hmm. both. But they can't leave, but they can't afford anything either.
Yeah.
And so it's this weird little moment. I will say another benefit, though, for that type of entertainment job is that it's one of the only areas where, okay, so maybe you're not the greatest concept artist in the world, but you've got aspirations. You can get in as doing something else, either cleanup or storyboarding or something. And it offers lateral and slight adjustment type moves within a company. There's not a lot of that with it. Either in book publishing, you either get it or you don't. And typically people who are already ready for it get it. There's not a halfway kind of position like there is in that world.
That's a really good point. I knew a handful of people at Blue Sky who came on as production assistants. So they were just basically like making sure people got the work done that they needed to and managing schedules and stuff like that. And while they were doing that at night, they were practicing the craft and bringing it in and showing the professionals and saying, hey, how do I make this better? And getting like, you know, one-on-one time with professionals. And then as soon as a job opens up, they're, you know, one of the first in line to get the job.
Yeah. Yeah, that's awesome. We always had the kind of the running joke because, you know, like I said, Laika is here. They did Coraline and those movies, if you're not familiar with them. And puppet sanding was always kind of the running joke because they need people to sand those puppets. And so what would happen is somebody would go from school. They'd be like big fish in school, like really great artists. They get the shot at Laika, you know, with stars in their eyes, and all of a sudden they're sanding puppets, and they get really depressed about it. But then, you know, slowly but surely, they, you know, sand the puppets for most of the day, but then get to do a little bit of concept work, and then pretty soon you see them a year later, and they're full staff doing what they want to be doing. Mm-hmm. So sand the puppets. Great. That's what we'd always say. Pay your dues. Don't think that it's just going to be all glamour. You know, pay some dues.
Sand the puppets.
Sand the puppets. All right. The next one all three of us are doing as part of our career model right now is art fairs or art cons or whatever you want to call it, events.
Comic cons,
yeah. And so I'm just going to lay out three different tiers. Again, it's for the early pro, the mid pro, and the season pro. These vary wildly depending on the work. But for new students or students who are just out of school who get a booth, so you don't always have to get like the full giant tent or something like that, or like the giant real estate if it's at a Comic Con. You get a table. And typically, at least here in Portland, Rose City Comic Con and things like that, it's between, a student will make between $500 and $1,200, which is fantastic as a student. Like most of the time, my students who have done that are just shocked that they made money anyway, like doing just work that they like. And they're selling prints and things like that. So that's kind of the business model. And then once you kind of figure things out after a couple of years, your costs go up. You start getting a little bit more real estate at these things. And you can, you know, make anywhere from $1,200 to $5,000. And then once you really figure it out, like Will has done at this point, I think all three of us actually have, we know exactly who our market is, who, what they buy, what they look for. And we all have pretty dialed in setups, and you can make easily 6,000, if not upwards, 30K, 40K is not unusual in a weekend.
Mm-hmm. It's unusual for me.
Well, I guess that would be unusual. I mean, there was a photographer next to me. I did a show in Sausalito, California, right across from San Francisco. A lot of money there, a lot of people with disposable income. And this guy was a travel photographer, and he had two booths. So he had a 10-foot by 20-foot space. Massive amount of cost went into this thing. But I would not doubt it if he was at 75K at the end of the 3 days.
Wow.
Wow.
Well, I can, since we're sharing numbers, I can actually share some.
Oh, please do. That would be awesome. So you're talking for a seasoned pro. This is not your early numbers. This is now.
This is now, but it's not as glamorous as you might think. I mean, some of our shows have been really low, like, you know, a few $2,000 or $3,000, which barely covered expenses. To, you know, our best show to date was in Seattle, where we almost made $19,000 gross. And for the last year, I think we formed a separate LLC. When I say we, it's my business partner on that. There's no way that I could do all of that alone. And so I found a guy that I really trust. And I talked about all this on my YouTube channel. But we came in just under $100,000 last year gross. I know about 30% of that was expenses. And so, you know, figure on about 2/3 of that was profit. And that got split between us. And so it's not a ton of money, but it was a good little extra chunk of income. This year, we're already on track to blow that out of the water. So that's good news. You know, we've kind of dialed it in a little bit more. But I don't want people going away thinking you could make, you know, $30,000 or $40,000 in a weekend, every single weekend. So then if you calculate that out times 52.
That's a good point. These things are separated by months sometimes.
Right.
And typically the summer has a little bit more, but it's a fairly easy thing to get into and make a little bit of money if you want to do it. The cool thing about it is it kind of sits there. Me and Will have talked about this, that if the wheels come off the bus and nobody ever hires us again as illustrators, we know that this market works for us, that we could, that if you had to kind of put your head down and just do Comic Cons or in my case, it would be art fair, you could make a full living at it.
Right. And that's a great point. We've talked about that before. Like if worse came to worse and we had to dive into this full time, we could make that number go way higher. But I wouldn't want that lifestyle.
I guess I should add on top of this, it's kind of funny how this is kind of a meandering conversation, but out of the stuff that we've been talking about, I think all three of us do all three things that we've mentioned so far, even currently.
Yeah.
Most illustrators that I know are not, I mean, Dan Santat, let's say for example, is a book illustrator. He's not going to design your character. He's not going to do an art fair. He's just a book illustrator. But a lot of the illustrators that I know really are kind of like, okay, I'm going to do these three shows in a year. I'm going to do these books. I'm going to teach this class. It's a kind of a collective. Would you guys agree?
It's the table, right? So you have a table, a financial table, and the more legs you prop underneath it, the more stable that table is going to be. And if a leg gets kicked out from under the table, it could still stay standing. So you could lose, you know, maybe no more freelance work's coming in for whatever reason. You still have two or three other legs that could keep this table afloat.
Yeah. This was actually going to be my main idea for this whole thing is of all the, there's two groups of professional artists, illustrators that I know. And the first is what you mentioned, Lee. It's the Dan Santad. It's the person who's won the Caldecott. If you don't know what the Caldecott medal is, you should really look that up, you know, just Wikipedia it. But they can afford to only do children's books or, you know, only do comics or only do animation or whatever it is that they're into. Because, like, take a Todd McFarlane or you take a Mike Mignola, you know, someone who has reached the pinnacle in their chosen profession and now they don't have to take other things. But the second group are, and these are artists, I have a whole list of these guys and gals who make a great living. I mean, six figures plus, but they're piecing it together, like you said, Jake, with a lot of different table legs. And so when I hear, you know, I'll hear a student sometimes say, I just want to illustrate calendars. Have you ever heard that? You guys?
Is that a thing?
Yeah, I just want to illustrate calendars. That's like my thing. I could just see my art in calendars. And right away, what I understand is they don't understand the market at all and how and why should they? It's never talked about in school, you know? So, but, you know, people that say, I just want to illustrate children's books, they're also doing magazines and they're doing textbooks. We haven't talked about children's textbooks. There's a lot of work there. They're filling it in, doing design and advertising work. Like right now I'm doing a picture book, but I'm also just starting a character design job for a game. And, you know, it's a fun job, but I call myself a children's book illustrator, but I do a lot of other
things.
Well, I like that business model too. And that's kind of why I do it because I like doing the books, but then I get burned out on the books a little bit because it's such a long time and I'm typically at the computer. And that's what I love about the art fairs is it's doing traditional watercolor paintings and then you're getting out and you're talking to people. I'm real social. And so it fulfills that need. And so you can kind of piece together this life that you know, that works for you, which is kind of cool. So we have learned that you should have a stable table and you should sand the puppets.
By the way, do you guys want some random facts that I looked up for this?
Sure.
Okay. How many children's book titles do you think are printed every year, roughly? This would include all juvenile books.
All juvenile
20K. Books.
That's pretty close.
Yeah, I would say some in the 15K.
Well, of course you're going to say that now.
You got ballpark.
According to BookScan, 25,000, roughly.
25,000.
Yeah. And let me ask you this. How many comic books do you think are sold each year?
Like different titles, right?
No, not just the titles, all comic books. I don't have...
Oh, all comics.
Yeah, I'm kind of switching
millions.
Categories.
Millions.
This is according to Quora. How many do you think, Lee?
Oh, man. Individual comic books sold?
Individual comic books.
Oh, my God. That would be just me pulling a number out of absolutely thin air.
See if you can beat Jake.
I say 32 million.
Jake, you just have to go up or down.
Just tell me. I play these games all the time with my kids at home, and I don't want to play it for a podcast.
418 million comic books sold each year.
That's now, incredible.
Now, do you think, I'm not letting you off the hook on this one, do you think there are more children's books sold than comic books or more comic books sold than children's books?
More comic books.
Dang it. Yeah, 178 million juvenile fiction books.
I would think your market is so much bigger with comics. That's why.
Because yeah.
Well, it's the actual kids that are buying it versus yeah. Typically with picture books, it's only the parents buying it and it limits your market.
And your average comic book collector is picking up 10 issues a week, you know, yeah. Something like that.
And they're cheaper.
And I wonder, does that count digital downloads?
No, this
too?
Is print. Oh. 172 million graphic novels sold each year, and all print books together are 674 million, but that does not include comic books.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah, someone's making some money.
Yeah. The person that was asking this question on Twitter originally had also kind of said, you know, like, where should I target? Where should I go? Where's the most money? Where am I going to have the most success? Should I go into comics? Should I go into children's books? Should I go into animation?
Yeah, because that gets to my next part.
Okay.
This is just part. I mean, this one's going to be a long one because this is we're about 50 minutes in, it looks like, and we've gotten to the end of question one.
Lee, I'm very proud of you for holding me off.
Wait. Is that all the different career paths you're going to go through?
We kind of have to go on, but there's a couple things I want to say about it. So we didn't even get to the end of the art fairs and cons. So some listeners are probably going to be sitting there thinking, well, that's great for you guys now that you got it figured out. But this one particular area, I mean, I do think we should have just an individual class on it because nobody, this isn't even taught in schools. Like, how do you even start with the cons? And so my ideas for you, the listener, to understand this business is go to as many cons as you can, take pictures of the setup, ask the artists where they ordered some of the setup stuff. Don't linger around the booth or anything, but do your research and development like any normal person would starting a business. The art fairs and the cons are a little bit different than the other areas in that there's upfront costs that are physical. Like you're selling prints, that means you need a good printer. That means you need the to actually make the prints and the bags and getting all the stuff there. And so there's just a little bit more kind of scheduling and things you got to do to get into it. But go check out your local one at your local city, and then you, like I said, attend it, and then try to do the minimum thing you can do the first year, just to see if people, what kind of work people like. Don't look at getting a profiting from it, and then kind of build from there. And you can scale really rapidly in this particular area once you know what people are buying and what they want and price points.
Can I add just a little bit of con etiquette there too? Is never get in the way of a sale. So if someone's like, if you guys selling something and trying to work a sale there, not a good time to butt your head in and be like, no, where do you actually get your prints made and what kind of printer is that?
No.
And hold your questions to one or two at max. Don't sit there and interview the person about every single thing that they've done, because I've gotten that before and it's kind of maddening.
If you do want to interview them, maybe buy, you know, a couple of prints off of them or something.
That goes a long way. It's a great point, Jake.
Yeah.
So at the tail end of that, there's, like Jake just said, I mean, there's so many areas we can go into. Those are kind of the main ones, unless you guys can think of another one. But I did want to bring in before even mentioning another one, there's advertising, illustration, all this other stuff. The pricing and ethical guideline put out by the Graphic Arts Guild. I thought we would discuss that for a minute. If you guys don't know what that is, it's a book. It's probably, I'm just guessing here, 200 pages. And it is available digital download. And it comes with forms that you, like model releases and illustration contracts. And it gives actual figures for, you know, oh, I got asked to do a billboard. How much do I charge to do a billboard? It'll say illustrating a billboard for a small to medium sized company, and it'll have a number there. And
now, you know that I hate that book.
Oh, everyone hates it. The reason that I like it is because it does talk about the rights and how to go about quoting for a lot of different areas. I would just say it's just step one in making a quote. And sometimes clients, if they're out of the blue, they don't even know where you're getting these numbers from. And it can be very reassuring for a client to be able to show them this book. Again, I think the book's a little high in a lot of areas, but at least it's a starting point, and at least it's something you can look at and say, I either accept what they're saying or I think what they're saying is wrong. But I think it's worse to not have any starting point.
Yeah, that's good.
I'm not going to derail this conversation by going into a diatribe on that book.
Give me 1 minute. Give me 20 seconds.
20 seconds.
Okay. 20 seconds
equals
a minute. Okay. So my thing is, if the client says, well, this is how much we have and it's half as much, then the book didn't help. If you look at the number and you go, I can't possibly do this for that number because the client has asked for parameters that are so much more detailed, or your style takes so much longer, then you're underpricing. I have a whole, I'm not going to do it here, but I have a whole method of how you should come up with a price. And I made a YouTube video out of it, which I think is better than that. Having said that, I agree with what you're saying, Lee. At least you can maybe have a ballpark of where to start. But I find that it rarely has worked. And I've had so many questions when I was starting out where I would look at the numbers and I would ask pros like, really, should I charge that much? And they're like, oh, no, you'll never get that much. Or later on, looking at that book and going, well, I got way more than that. It just seems so, because every job is so different. About the, you know, if there was a pricing guideline, maybe on the publishing section, because for children's publishing, the budgets, like you mentioned in the beginning, are pretty standard. And that's like one of the only areas in illustration that I've found that really does kind of have a standard of pricing, because the editors at publishers, they have a budget to work with and it's a take it or leave it proposition. They really don't bargain much. It's not like you can, you know, they offer you 10,000, you say, I'll do it for 20. You're not going to do the job.
Well, this is kind of one of the benefits. Again, I don't want to get in too much into these conversations where the listeners are saying, oh, it must be nice to have that because I don't have it. But like an agent takes care of a lot of this stuff because they've already quoted it a number of times. And it's one thing that I was always just really anxious when I had to quote something. And I 100% agree with you, Will, that like to think you're going to open the book and just type in whatever the book says, not even going to be close. But at least, like I said, I would use it as a starting point. And then asking your peers, having a good peer group is fantastic because you guys are all going to be sort of at the same level and some of you are going to get work. What I did at the beginning of my career right out of school was I had a group of people that I hung out with at school. And we made a document that we all shared that was, you don't list the actual client, but you list like A tier, which would be, you know, your big top five publishers, B tier, and so on. And then you'd say, kind of list out the parameters of the job and what you got paid. And so that way you're not getting into price fixing or saying, hey, you have to charge this. It was just like, here's a record of how much I made on this one job. And it was fantastic. It was a fantastic resource for a little while. Because I remember one time getting a book cover and literally being stumped. I have no idea how much to charge for that. And I went to that document and it was pretty good. There was a few of them on there. They were sort of consistent. So that's what I threw out and that's what I got. And I was happy with it. So
I will say that in the beginning of your career to this, maybe even middle or high middle, if you get what that book says, you're doing good in general.
Yeah. Yeah. Maybe the inverse is true as you're a seasoned pro. Like if you're getting what that book is saying, you're leaving money on the table. I don't know.
Yeah.
All right. So moving forward. So that was question one. Let's go on. Here's my other areas. I'll go ahead and throw out to you guys and you can say what to keep and what to lose. So my next question is, what's the best net? They're not all as long, by the way. What is the best route for making a living as an illustrator? I've just got a couple of hit points for that. What are some financial things that no one thinks about as a freelancer? There's a couple of things I want to mention there, but I don't know. How much time do we have? And then financial success recipe is the ending. So
I would say, let's do them. Hit those.
Bang through them.
Yeah.
Okay. So what's the, I'll just add something and you guys can either correct it or fight with me or whatever. So what's the best route for making a living as an illustrator? Again, very general. Have a job that pays the bills first. Thinking that you're just going to graduate from school and make a full-time living as an illustrator is probably foolish a little bit. And if you have a job that pays, whether it's art related or not, then you can transition into illustration with a proven business model, with clients that you can bank on. As you start to think about your art career, think about the need in the industry and how easy it is to get into that niche. How applicable is your skill set to what's needed in the marketplace? So a lot of students don't think that because students don't think that way because schools teach you to be your own little snowflake, not to borrow from politics too much, but schools just say, oh, just draw whatever you want. And pretty soon, by the time you're a senior, you're thinking, well, I'm going to make a couple of puppets. I'm going to sand them down. What's funny in school is it's so random what people make without ever having to say, who would be a target market for this? Who would be an audience for this? Who's a potential client for this? And it's so funny. It's almost like personal. It's illustration kind of masquerading as fine art in a weird way. I think anytime a student pitches a project in school, they need to say who the market is, what the budget would be, what the rights would be, and start to understand that stuff. So that's what I would say. Great. That's the route.
Yeah, I agree with that, especially the have a day job until there's enough work coming in that justifies you quitting the day job, or have a spouse or a significant other that has a great day job that allows you to, you know, run that runway. Take that runway as long as it needs to take before you take off. My experience: I worked in the animation industry while doing publishing projects on the side and at night and on weekends before I felt like it was time for me to go fully independent.
Yeah, it's perfect. And I mean, Yuko Shimizu too, very famous illustrator right now. She did the same thing. She was in corporate America doing her thing until she had a proven track record and a proven client list, and then she bailed and went full time. She's been very successful. So I think there's something to that.
Mm-hmm. Can I add really quick?
Yeah.
So mine is going to be sort of like the golden rule, right? So the golden rule is treat others as you want to be treated, right?
Okay.
Is that right?
Yeah.
I'm just waiting for confirmation.
Where are you going with it?
So it's overly simplistic, right? But yet it would solve like all the world's problems, right?
Right.
Okay. So what will solve all of your artistic career problems is what Neil Gaiman said in his commencement speech. I can't remember it. Was it Stanford, I believe?
Something like
which
that.
He said, make great art. It is so simple. And my fear is that most people, especially students, when I was a student, if I had heard that, I'd be like, yeah, it's easy to, you know, it doesn't solve anything. It solves everything. If you're making great art, then when clients see your work, they hire you. You know what I mean? Like, it is so simple, but it is so true. And for all of the professional artists that I know that are doing really well, I mean, all of them make great art. Now, their art could be a combination of writing and visual art to make a book, you know. So you take someone like Matthew Inman, the guy who did The Exploding Kittens, who does The Oatmeal, and you look at the art alone, it looks like crap. You look at the writing alone, it sounds like crap. You put them together and it's magical. So that's what I'm talking about, making great art. It doesn't have to be highly rendered. It could be high concept. But whatever that is, those are the artists who are quote unquote killing it right now. They're the ones that are making great art.
I'm gonna sort of disagree with you.
Uh oh.
Hold on. Before you disagree, I just want to refer back to episode 3, Ship Happens. We outlined a list, like a sort of a battle plan. Here's what you need to do in year 1, year 2, year 3 in order to make great art and get your work up to the quality that it needs to be. So reference that if you're wondering how you actually go about making great art. Okay, Lee.
Hit me.
How I disagree with that. I mean, I think it's true. The baseline of it is if your work's not good, all this other stuff doesn't really matter too much.
Right.
So you do have to make great art. But my problem is, like I just said about students at universities just kind of going and doing their own thing without a reference to the market. I would say you got to make great art, but you also have to understand how images are sold. If you want to make this a career, you have to start thinking in a business, some kind of business mindset, and understand that, you know, even that Exploding Kittens there, who's the market for that? Do people want it? I guarantee you there was a proof of concept there.
Right.
So
yeah, you have to be smart as well. But you take someone like Piper Thibodeau, who, and you can look her up. She's got a really popular Twitter.
Check the show notes.
So, you know, she did the daily paintings, made great art while she was in school. And then she started working for companies like Sesame Street, DreamWorks, Scholastic, and a few others. I think HarperCollins. Anyway, you're right, Lee, but you're also wrong in that if you put your art in the right place and people can find it, if it's amazing, good things will start to happen. And yes, you have to be smart.
But putting your art in the right place is what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
a little side note. I went to at one point I was living in San Francisco, and I was actually I played drums when I was growing up, and so at one point I was thinking that maybe I would be a drummer, and I went to this club in San Francisco, and there was a jazz band playing, and they were killing it. I mean, this guy would be where I would be if I just did that all day for, you know, the next 5 years or something, or 7 years, whatever. And there was more people in the band than there was in the audience. So he was making great art.
Yeah.
There was no one to watch it.
Yeah. That's a good point.
The two have to go hand in hand, you know?
Good point.
So, okay. So what are some financial things that no one thinks about as a freelancer? Taxes is one of them that I had listed. A lot of people kind of fall victim to that. I don't know if you guys did right when we got out of school and you start making money and you get like, say, a $10,000 job and you think, oh my gosh, I'm in the money. I've never made a $10,000 job. And you put it in the bank and you don't realize that at least 30% of that's going to get taken. Again, coming down to understanding basic principles as a business and understanding the things that you have to pay is going to be absolutely crucial. And I can't recommend this enough. Get Quicken Self-Employed. If you're even thinking about being a professional, get Quicken Self-Employed. I receive no kickback, by the way. This is just what I use, and it's awesome. But maybe I should get a kickback if they get a bunch of business. I don't know. But it's fantastic because it kind of shows you like, oh, here's how much I made. You enter it in, and it'll tell you exactly how much you have to pay as a quarterly tax payment. And so you just start to understand the business. If you're going to be a freelancer, you're saying, I'm in business now, and these things come with it. So one thing I like to talk to my students about is dollar cost averaging. And I don't want to get too much into finance and stuff, but this is a really simple idea. If you make $1, what happens to that $1? And if you can understand that, you can understand it at a bigger scale.
How much do you get to blow?
Yeah. And this is the crucial one about the weird workaround with this whole thing is how much do you really have to make? And I'll show you how that works. If you make a dollar, if I make a dollar, say 20% goes straight to my agent. Right. And so 20 cents is gone. And then 30% of that dollar go to taxes. And I'm just going to use simple math here. I know it breaks down a little bit different. So how much do I have left? 50 cents?
Well, you're not paying your taxes on your agent's money. So
no, but I mean, well, that's what I said. It's not exactly one to one. I don't want to get into like dollars and cents on the phone, but so 50 cents, roughly 50 cents is taken, and that doesn't count deductibles and all that stuff. I get that. But 50 cents is gone, say for example. So now if so out of every dollar, half of it's gone, how much do I need to make? And now all of a sudden the number, my illustration career looks a lot different. If I need say $50,000 a year to live, pay my rent, pay my mortgage, whatever, I now need to gross 100 grand. And that's all of a sudden, it's a much different number than, you know, what you thought it was. I would typically say, oh, I need to make 50 grand. I'd be good. But then when the money comes out, does that make sense?
Yeah. If you make 100 grand in a job, you know, where your employer's paying half of your FICA, and of course, we're talking in the U.S. and a lot of people don't pay FICA around the world, but they pay other taxes. You'll have to find out, you know, how much, what it equates to. But here in the U.S., if you make 100 grand in a job, that's like making probably like 120, 130 self-employed.
Yeah.
Because, you've got to pay, you just have more
taxes. You understand where all the money goes.
You don't get the benefit of health insurance.
Right. Yeah. And you got to pay for advertising and all that other stuff. So just take $1, break down where all of it would go, advertising, bills, tax, agent, all that kind of stuff. And then you can kind of scale up. It's a lot easier to scale a dollar for some reason. I've had students work through this exercise and it's pretty interesting. And it's sometimes shocking because you have to make a lot more than you thought, but at least you're understanding it correctly.
And don't discount too that you have to pay your own health benefits. If you want to save money, you got to account for that. Nobody's matching your 401k, things like that. I want to add too that I worked a full-time job in animation for 12 years, different studios. And during that time I had two kids, and I don't really remember their younger years that well, because I would barely see them before they woke up in the morning. And then I would see them for about an hour at night before it was time for them to go to bed. And when I started working for myself in my home, we had a couple more kids. I have five kids now. And the three younger kids, I really got to know them as children. And I got to see them and eat lunch with them and spend time with them and take an afternoon break with them. And I have made, less money than I would if I had continued working for a studio. But the trade-off was, and I talked to my wife about this, and I said, do you wish I'd stayed at a studio? Or did you like having me? Have you liked having me here? And she's like, no, it's been really good to have you be in our home and be a part of the family. And so that was one of the big benefits. It wasn't a financial one, but it was a life benefit of me working for myself, even though, it really was hard paying health benefits, out of pocket, and taxes were a pain, and just not knowing when checks were going to come in or if I would, get the kind of advance I was expecting to get on this book deal and things like that. The trade-off, though, was just being present and having this work-life balance that I never had before, and being able to go see a movie at, 10 a.m. if I want to, knowing that I could make the work up later on my own time,
That's a great point. It's a great point. Why don't we end on that? Because all the other stuff is just kind of reiterating some of this other stuff we've talked about.
Okay.
Yeah.
Let's do that. This is a good episode.
It was. Lee. And this is the talk that I wanted to have in school and we never really got.
Yeah. Likewise. Well, you have been listening to 3-Point Perspective. Let me find my notes here. I don't have it memorized yet. Okay, 3-Point Perspective is made possible by svslearn.com, where becoming a great illustrator starts. And I just want to add, if you haven't checked out our courses on svslearn.com, Lee, Will, and I are all teaching exactly how to get better, how to make great art, and to level up. And so please check out those. There's a pretty low monthly subscription where you can get access to them. Your hosts have been Will Terry. You can find his work at willterry.com. Instagram account is at willterryart, and check him out on YouTube. Lee White, check his artwork out at leewhiteillustration.com. Instagram account is at leewhiteillo. And I'm Jake Parker. It's mrjakeparker.com. Instagram account at Jake Parker, and I'm on YouTube as well. If you like this episode, please share it around. We appreciate everybody who's been tweeting out this podcast and sharing it around. You guys are awesome. If you haven't yet, subscribe to it on iTunes so you can be notified exactly when our next episode drops. And we would love it if you left a review. Those reviews are like oxygen for us, and they really put in energy for us to want to make more of these episodes. So we love hearing what you think. If you're wanting to join in on this discussion, we have a thread in the svslearn.com forums where we've posted specifically about this episode. So share your own experiences or ask some more questions, and we'd love to hear what you think. And that is all. Thank you very much, and we will talk to you guys next time.
Start with a joke.
Actually, I have a joke I made up last night.
We should do. I'll do one joke every podcast. The SVS joke.
It's a dad joke.
Here we go. How do fish get to the hospital?
How?
They swim.
Lambulance. Boom.
Here's my joke. I made this one up last night. How does a frog? What does a frog use to wrap a gift?
What?
Ribbon. Ribbon.
How do you make a cat go woof?
I don't know.
You douse him in gas and light him with a match. How do you make a dog go meow?
How?
You freeze him and then run him through a bandsaw.
Wow. Meow.
Start this episode.
I don't think we should share these jokes with anybody.
Horrible idea.
What's funny is, apologize. Like 5 years ago, you could have shared those on Facebook, I swear.
Now
they'd come to your house and arrest you.